Blog Talk Radio.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue.
I learned more about the heart of leadership than the arch of leadership. What Eric Powell does in this session is make the leader in you come alive.
Welcome to the show. You're listening to On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Thanks for joining us. Friends, no matter if you're the artist or the teacher or the speechwriter or the candidate, no matter the role, you have a purpose and you're a leader in that purpose. Our goal here is simple at On Cue Radio: to inspire and equip, to transform to new leaders, to help them leave where they are. In other words, get us on cue with God's will, on cue with his calling on our lives, which is our purpose, and get others on cue with that purpose. What is cue? It is how Nehemiah, a model transformational leader who led a starved, desperate, isolated, broken people in building a wall around ancient Jerusalem and essentially bend the way of life. He C-U-E them up. C is for common ground. What can we agree on is the why we come together. U is unified thought. It's what vision can we share, and it's the what. And E is the equally yoke. What is the game plan? What success look like? What's my role in that? And how is the how we're going to do this together? So broadly, Q leadership integrate biblical principles of leadership using the Nehemiah as a model and helping you do two things. One, get people to trust you, and two, get people to follow you. Trust and discipleship, those are the two axes of leadership, no matter where you are in life. So as we always do, we want to start our show with a prayer. So Lord, you are a powerful, merciful, living God. Lord, we thank you for this day. Lord, lead and bless this ministry and our audience and all that are serving you. We know that this Q leadership is your brainchild, our calling in your name, but we honor you today, Lord, by doing two things, by giving you the glory, and two, serving this generation through Q. Lord, your words in Romans 12:2 tells us, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and the perfect will of God. Lord, use this ministry to complete that purpose, to align, equip, transform some new leaders for your glory, and help others hear that call, receive the call, and Lord, bless us so we can help raise new transformational leaders and gatekeepers in your name. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. Our show, What to Expect. We always like to have a dialogue, a conversation about leadership based in God's word. Equip leaders with a roadmap to tap into faith and build trust and build discipleship. And lastly, highlight some everyday leaders who are making a difference and that can testify to God's goodness in their lives and where they're being transformational. Lord, our show is a lot of things, but it's not to criticize, but to shine some light and some truth and love. And not to tell you what to do, but provide a different lens in order to see things. And it's not really to focus on mere symptoms of a problem, but get to the root of the problem. And in essence, treat the infection, not the runny nose. So today, as with any day, let's be open. And we pray that we hear the Lord, not me. And let us have the right questions. No matter what the differences may be, remember that this life is about love and surrender. And there may be differences of opinions, but let's do what a true transformation leader says. Let us agree without being disagreeable. And let's be thought partners, be a fruitful dialogue, as we know. So let's kick things off. This week, we experienced one of the rights that we have in our nation, and it was the right to vote. Not many people in the world enjoy the freedoms and the free elections as we do. We're actually blessed, and a lot of people have died for those rights for all of us in this nation. We had some winners, and we had some losers. I think the biggest story is that the Republicans regained control of the House or the Senate. No matter what you decided, how you land on, it was newsworthy. We all hear some in the process. We heard a lot of concession speeches. Those in local, state, and federal races, and there were some unique ones. But I thought through the show this morning, I thought, you know, what are some of the famous ones or some recent ones that we've heard? You go to the mind where the concession speaker Mitt Romney recently, he said, I wish that I had been able to fulfill your hopes, he said, but the nation chose another leader, and that was true. And or back in 1952, Adlai Stevenson, said about Eisenhower, "It hurts too much to laugh. I'm too old to cry," he said. "I urge you to all give General Eisenhower the support he will need to carry out the great tasks that lie before him. And I pledge him mine. We vote as many, but we pray as one." And so, and there's another one. Even recently in 2008 with then-Senator Hillary Clinton, she said, "Although we weren't able to shatter the highest and hardest glass ceiling this time, thanks to you, it got about 18 million cracks in it. And the light is shining through that like never before, filling us with all the hope and sure knowledge that the path that we will be a little easier next time." So, but if you think about it, you should probably know a few others in your state and local races that you've seen that's probably moved you or you've thought about. But if you think about the parts and components of a concession speech, someone's final swan song, if you will, of a lone campaign, is something that's filled with hope of the future lots of times. But if you look closer, there are some components that you may realize that is there or you may not realize. The first part of it, no one really admits defeat. They kind of paraphrase the concession speech in the sense it does not mention the word concession at all lots of times to speakers, but everyone still understands that the speaker is conceding. So they would not necessarily admit defeat, and they try to endure. So the second part of it, you hear a candidate praise the opponent, often to cast the opponent in a different light, because of the bad things they've said during the campaign, but it's also a way of asking for forgiveness. So that they're praise that challenger in such a way, and then congratulate the winning candidate, wish them well in the office, which is also this traditional thing to do. The next part of you here, a thank you to those who've helped this particular person or candidate on this campaign, volunteers, voters, and just the valiant efforts of everyone that's been involved. A give thanks to supporters. And also the times and resources, donations people have chosen to support them in a candidacy. Another piece of that, of a concession speech, you hear a call for unity. And now that it's over, in some cases you may have this, someone, "I'm being the bigger person here, and I want to call for unity." And perhaps it's probably the most crucial part of concession things, because it essentially calls us to be on one accord behind the new leader who has been elected during the voting process. The next piece we always hear is talk about our democracy, about the youthfulness of it, but also the future of it. And this is they tie this to one's opponent and also our democracy. It's a higher purpose. It's calling of a higher person to make this nation great. You always hear that. And then the next piece, there's two more pieces connected to that you hear is the fight continues. You know, they seek to clarify, despite my loss as a candidate, we'll continue to fight for this platform, perhaps by running for office again, keeping the door open that we'll continue to fight for this platform. So there's a lot of points about the success of the campaign, although we did not win. It's like even it's a bad loss in lots of things. Building party strength. They go for raising issues to attention that would not have been otherwise in public discussion, and offer parting words and advice lots of times in that fight, and really just trying to seek that clarity of the issues and hardships and so forth, and in order to remind people why he or she was running. And the last piece is always end with is God and prayer. And mentioning God and praying for an opponent's well-being serves two purposes in a lot of different ways. Reminding the audience that and oneself to put the loss in perspective, and the second is reaffirming that person's religious credentials. Even though some speeches, as we know in recent times, are kind of devoid of religion, unless it's just always until the end, or some spiritual element or mention of God until at the end. God bless America. That's the way you kind of get away with it. So it's just kind of run through those components, and if you next time you hear these speeches, kind of think about those elements. And even, I guess the question also came to mind was, has anyone ever refused to concede? And I said, wow, there are a few, and I was not necessarily surprised, but 1876, Samuel Tilden lost a disputed election, and he won the popular vote, but lost the Electoral College. And basically, highly unorthodox concession speech, he didn't give it to 8 months later after Election Day. Even recent times, in this past summer, running for, there's 2 days after the Mississippi Senate race where the Chris McDaniel and Thad Cochran, McDaniel was still refusing to concede to the winner, the incumbent of Thad Cochran. There's a whole lot of politics around that we won't go into. And even in this cycle, we had a Republican Senate race in New Hampshire, I believe, where Scott Brown refused to concede to the race of the Democrat incumbent Jeanne Sheehan. And there's a few others that have done. But, you know, my question then was, why would someone not concede? It could be part of ego or stubbornness or embarrassment or maybe some wisdom. They're waiting for all the votes to come in. Maybe it's some sort of shame, or it's a variety of reasons, but even just hope for a runoff or really faith in the process. You know, and when everything, if you kind of put it in perspective as to when we bring the Lord into a concession speech, when everything's stacked against you, you have no more fight, everything, all the numbers say that you're lost, what do you do? What do you do? And you know, that's always a question. You know, what do you do when it comes to that point? And are you bowing down to your circumstances or to your fears or your tears or even your situation? Or are you refusing to concede? Which really is our question of the day. And helping us with that is we're pleased to bring in Monica Curiel after the break. We're going to bring her in, but she's a 20-year-old student. Who's waging her own campaign, against lymphoma. And Monica will share her experience that she's gone through. She's young, she's gifted, she's called, and she will share her advice to others in her position and also will help us in answering that question of the day. Are you refusing to concede? So after the break, we will bring Monica on. And so during the break, stay with us, share your thoughts, love on her, ask any questions you may have. Stay with you. Can't afford to miss this. We're taking calls. Our number is 310-861-2331. If you want to ask a question or make a comment, press 1 on your telephone. It raises your hand virtually, and then my daughter Kennedy can bring you into the chat. Or you can log into our live chat room at Blog Talk at on Q Radio and bring discussion there and have a live chat with Kennedy as well. And so, friends, we'd love to hear from you. Please call us at 310-861-2331. This is On Q. I'm your host, Eric Powell. We'll be right back.
Them where they are by getting them on cue with God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on the queue.
I learned more about the heart of leadership than the arch of leadership. What Eric Powell does in this session is makes the leader in you come alive.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue.
It should be a mandatory part of every church pre-membership class, every school leadership program. I think this curriculum effectively used not only positions the person for better leadership, but positions the person for better life.
And we're back. Thanks for staying with us and listening on cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Remember, our mission here is simple, friends, to help you lead where you are by getting you on cue with God's will and his purpose. So today's question, we're talking about Monica's election. The question is refusing to concede, refusing to succeed. So helping us with that is you. So please call us at 310-861-2331 or also helping us with that is our special guest, Monica Curiel. She is a 20-year-old student who has been waging a war, a campaign against lymphoma at a young age where she's somewhat the prime of her life and young, gifted, and called, and this hits her, and she's here to share her story, her advice to others in her position, and really help us answer that question of the day. So let's give her a virtual applause. Monica, welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely. Good to hear your voice. It's been a long time since I've seen you, but thanks for taking the time out this Sunday evening.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you so much. I'm very excited about this.
Absolutely. You know, Monica, you know, we always start our show with two questions, and it goes from there. But all right. I want to pose the first one to you and the second one. The first question is, what is that one word that describes you?
I think the one word that would really describe me at this point in my life is curious.
Curious. Okay. That's a good one. So say more.
All right. So I think curious because I am curious to know why things happen, know what I can do to change them, curious to see how I can help. Curious to get to know the world and the people in it. And, you know, knowledge is power. And so with curiosity comes that knowledge. Not, you know, the positive, you know, kind of aspect of curiosity, not the one that, you know, is leads you to bad decisions. But I think curious would would be a word I would use to describe me.
Wow, you know, I could probably stop the show and just go into each one of those points about know why things happen and how you can change things, how you can help people, and just know the world. You just threw me a curveball there, but I'm going to continue down our path here, but maybe I'll come back to it, right? But great, great answer. The second question is, if money was no issue, what would you do every day?
You know, if money wasn't an issue, regardless of where I would be in my life, I think I, more than anything, after having undergone what I've undergone, is really try to reach out to more people in need. And I don't say that stereotypically speaking. I really say that if I had the money to travel to different places and see pretty much every place in the world has a different kind of devastation or a different kind of sickness they're dealing with or, you know, a certain struggle. I think I would really, one, want to travel to those areas to help. Number two, for the food, because I would eat at a different restaurant like every day. And number three on weekends, be able to like go to Disneyland or concerts, you know, like a normal, you know, person in their 20s would.
Right. Oh man, that's great answer. It's really reaching out, and that's been consistent. It's consistent is, you know, not only what you've gone through, but even people who have not gone through what you're going through right now or have gone through. It was always about. It wasn't about. The answer was never about them. It's about serving other people. So that is awesome, and wouldn't expect anything less from you. So you know, we're gonna dig into a lot of different elements here. but in talking about your campaign against what you're dealing with. But listen, before we do, let's let the audience, those first two questions kind of help open the door to have people know you a little bit more. But let's get a little more detail. So tell us about you. Where are you from? And tell us about your family growing up.
Yeah, I'd love to. I am born and raised Texan in Dallas on the outskirts. I grew up kind of just, you know, with Texan pride, I guess. My background and my family is Hispanic. They come from Mexico and raised, you know, all American here and, you know, got to grow up in private schools, got really good education, you know, did some traveling here and there. So, you know, good childhood.
Good childhood, absolutely. What's your favorite memory as a kid? This is a new question.
You know what? That is a very good question. I think I would have to say that, and this is the fashion designer, you know, Aspire talking,
right,
is really, my family would come over, my aunts and my uncles and my cousins, and I would dress up in my mother's clothes. And I would put on her heels and take her hairbrush, and I'd perform and I'd sing. Because I thought, you know, in the future I'd be a pop star. You know, this was when, you know, Britney Spears was the limelight. And,
right,
and I just really wanted to be a pop star. I wanted to do that. And so my favorite memory was when my dad was just like, you know, what would you do if, you know, you can't sing later on in your life and you're not, you know, a very good singer? You know, just to see my response. And I was just like, oh, if I'm not, I will practice. You know, it was just a reminder. He was just like, that's it, baby. Just do what, you know, do you, and you can accomplish anything in life as long as, you know, you practice and you try hard. It's not always about having natural talent. But I got to tell you, I can't sing worth a darn. Like, you know, not even in the shower head tells me no.
I understand. I've been in plenty talent shows and haven't won one, so I understand.
Good. You feel my pain.
I feel your pain, but it doesn't stop me, though. It doesn't stop me.
That's so great.
So I was advised not to ask this question, but I'm going to ask it in a different way. Who is one of your favorite teachers?
All right. That is a very difficult one, because
I said one, just one, right?
Yeah, just one. You know, can I answer it this way? Can I answer by saying my favorite teachers all have a certain characteristic in common?
Absolutely. You know, we're going to put you up for office. I tell you, Monica for office. Okay, yes, absolutely. Characteristic.
You know, the teachers that I admired the most were the ones who were really eager to teach, the ones that weren't like classes over, resume to whatever you were doing, the kind that, you know, stayed after school and told you a little bit about their lives, who felt like, you know, they weren't only your teacher, but your mentor, your friend, the ones that always bestowed a certain kind of hope and a certain kind of faith that really inspired you to want to learn, that inspired you to want to, you know, do things in life. And I could say names, but I've been blessed to have several of those in my lifetime. And they've always been inspirational, that's for sure. Inspirational is what they've been.
Absolutely. I would take that answer all day. I take that answer all day. So I was advised not to ask it a little bit differently, but a great, great answer. You know, so you know, you grew up in Dallas, family-oriented, great teachers, great experience. And then you go off to college. So let's talk about following your dream, right? And then how things hit you in 2013.
Okay, yeah. Well, let's see. Growing up in Dallas, I attended all Catholic schools pretty much, except for, like, I switched off going to a public school in the midst of my high school years during my sophomore and junior year. And I did that mostly because I was, you know, being a teenager, you want to be social, you want to be outgoing. And I felt like, you know, I wanted to, you know, get to know more people other than the people I grew up with. And I was kind of in this stage where I was very like, more friends, you know, more glory kind of, you know, kind of thing that I think, you know, we all can relate to in the high school years. And so I went to this public school that had a lot more electives. And in the midst of that, every single year of, you know, my education lifetime, I would take art classes, and I loved art. And, you know, I'd win those little, you know, participation awards, as well as, you know, the ones that got third place and stuff. And so I always loved art, and it was very therapeutic for me. So as it got into my high school years, I had finished kind of all my credit for, like, the general art courses. So at the school, they had a fashion design course, and I found myself just really intrigued with sewing and designing and pattern drafting. And so I took it for 2 years. So it started my sophomore year. And my teacher, you know, the reason I went to the school was to meet more friends. But then I found that during lunch and breaks in my free period, I would be in the sewing room, not talking to anyone. So, you know, it was kind of like the opposite of, you know, whatever I had planned. And so she would just kind of take notice that I just was really into it and wanted to learn more. So, you know, those summers in between those years, I got to doing some of my own dresses, and some of my friends caught on, and they were like, hey, Monica, can you do my prom dress? Can you do me this dress? And then for my friends who were in college were like, do me a game day dress. And I was like, yeah, why not, you know? So I started doing that, and so my teacher had notified a school called FIDM Los Angeles, the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising, and she had contacted them to come down for a career fair. And so when I went to this career fair, they had already known about me, and I was just like, who are you guys, and how do you know my name? And, you know, she had told them my story and the portfolio I had, and, you know, I was like, well, thank you very much, but my father's not letting me go out of state. That's way too expensive, kind of thing. And by the time I was a senior, I decided to go back to the Catholic school, because at the end, I wanted to graduate with the people I grew up with. So,
right.
So I had, you know, kind of lost contact from that teacher. But to my surprise, these same scouts from, you know, this fashion school came out to that career fair kind of thing. And I saw them again. And they were just like, we're just really interested, and we really want you there. And, you know, God works in mysterious ways. So freshman year, you know, of college, I went to this school in Los Angeles, having grown up in Texas, and boy, was it a culture shock. I was like, you know, guys aren't opening my doors every which ways. People aren't saying
right,
y'all.
Right.
I say hello to people on the streets, and they're like, who are you? So, you know, totally different atmosphere.
That's Southern hospitality, but, right? I get it.
Man, I miss it all the time.
right. I understand. It's kind of like when I first met my wife going to Chicago. She said, don't speak to people on the street. So even though I was doing that, so years and years ago.
Right.
So you chose the Fashion Institute of Design and Merchandising in Los Angeles.
I did.
How was your first year?
Oh, man, it was tough. I'll tell you. You know, coming from, you know, all those years of, almost sheltered life, I feel, and you know, the Southern hospitality, having the same amount of friends, really, it was competitive. It was difficult. I wanted to go in to make wedding dresses, and I wanted to go in kind of not big time. A lot of people who were there aspired to be red carpet, you know, all the fame, all the glory, all the money. And, you know, I went with a kind of almost humble-esque attitude, and the fact that I was just like, you know, I just want a little boutique, and I want to do what I love, but I don't really care so much about money, you know. And people would be like, you know, then what are you doing here? You know,
like, oh, really?
People,
wow.
You know, people who want to do, you know, make it small don't come to this school. People who want, you know, big time, because you have people like, you know, the creator of Nordstrom who went to that school, you know, Juicy Couture and all these, you know, very, you know, known brands kind of thing. And so it was a challenge. It was a challenge for my faith. It was a challenge for my social life. I found that, you know, on the weekends when most of my friends in college were going to parties and this and that, I was either doing homework or sleeping. So it was not the lime life I had intended. But, you know,
right.
I found that I did, you know, I bestowed it a talent that I could work with, and that was nice. So as challenging as it was, I did experience, you know, the kind of willingness to not give up, to even
right.
though the guy, you know, the Asian gay guy next to me who was just a master at everything he did with fashion design, you know, I was competing with,
mm-hmm.
you know, I was like, I can be that good. I can be just as good as, you know, him. And so, you know, it was kind of as challenging as it was also a growth. And so I'm very happy and blessed that I had that opportunity to kind of see that world.
Absolutely. You know, it's nothing like being exposed to different things, especially at a competitive level, against people who can always help you grow, right? And that's anything
right.
in life. So as you go through, you know, you culture shop, competitive, tough,
right.
You know, doubt at times, but, and then something else even bigger and tougher hit you, right?
Right. So I'm in my last week's finals, just about to finish up my freshman year.
Mm-hmm.
And I go on, you know, getting ready to go on a date, very excited, like a girl in college would. Just normal, driving on the freeway, you know, listening to Rihanna or whatever's playing on the radio. And all of a sudden, I wake up, and I'm upside down in my car. And, well, later on, I realized that I had blacked out because I had several enlarged lymph nodes around my mediastinum and my throat that basically limited my breathing. And while I was singing in the car, it cut off my breathing, and so I blacked out. And, you know, it's quite amazing how it happened, really. The freeways in Los Angeles are pretty wide, and so, you know, I swerved four lanes over, and, you know, it was like 9 o'clock at night, so there was still heavy traffic, and I didn't hit a soul, and not a soul hit me, and, you know, it was quite an experience to wake up upside down in your car and have all the doors concaved in. And, you know, I just freaked out and I was like, whoa, how'd this happen? And, you know, I was coming back from the beach. So I had sandals on. I was trying to break windows. Well, that wasn't the smartest idea with sandals on. So then I kind of fainted out of, you know, anxiety that I think anyone would kind of undergo in that situation. And I was lucky enough to have a person who was coming back from war, and he was an Army paramedic, and he had saw me, and he helped me get out of the car. Now, normally you're not supposed to do that. It's technically, like, illegal in some states to not do that, but, boy, if he hadn't, you know, I don't know what would have happened, along with a very lovely woman who helped me out there. And so anyway, a couple weeks went by and, you know, the doctors were just like, well, Monica, we're trying to figure out if you have an infection or if you have cancer. And naturally, I looked at them and I just said, you know, I don't think you have the right chart because, see, I'm in my last week of finals. So if I can revisit this, in like 2 weeks so I can get my credit and maintain my GPA, I'll be back to talk to you about this. And that was dead serious. Like, you know, and I was just like, really, just give me the discharge papers. Let me go. I'll come back, I promise, and we'll figure this out. And the doctor just laughed, and they were like, you know, honey, that's not how it works. And I was just like, well, then tell me, how does this work? Because I'm pretty sure, you know, I can wait 2 weeks. And, you know, they were just like, you got to stay here. We got to do blood work. So it took about 3 weeks, to figure out the diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
And the diagnosis was that I had stage 2 Hodgkin's lymphoma. And I'll tell you, I was in a state of shock. I was in a state of denial. because one thinks, you know, other people get cancer and not me. And right. You know, like, my mentality was very much like, oh, I'm too young. I have too much to learn. You know, people are supposed to get cancer, illnesses, or those, you know, kind of Alzheimer's, any kind of other diseases, like, later on
not
in life,
me,
once
right.
they've lived their life. Right.
Yeah.
Not me.
Yeah.
Of course not me. You know, I was too young. And so it came as a shock. And, in fact, I thought it was something that I could just patch up and fix. And so, you know, I went, like, oh, gosh, I think, like, a couple weeks without telling my parents, without telling my friends. And people were like, where are you? And I was like, you know, this is going to be fixed. I'm going to fix this, you know, do whatever I got to do. Well, at the time, I didn't know anything about treatment or cancer or anything. And so, you know, then when I realized how difficult it was going to be, I think the hardest thing for me was allowing people to help me, was allowing myself to acknowledge the fact that I was scared. I was scared. And so that's when I called my dad and I was like, you know, doctor said that I have cancer. And of course people think cancer and they think death automatically, cause that's just, I guess, a stereotype. And he flew out and, my family was here, and it was a hard process cause I started losing my hair. And, you know, as a girl or as any individual, I feel we always talk about how vanity shouldn't be, you know, the foresight of things. And but it does kind of take its toll. And for me, you know, I had always had long hair to my waist, and you know, just having just, you know, taking a nap and waking up and having half of, you know, my hair on my pillow, you know, I didn't know quite how to react to that. And as it got sicker and sicker, I didn't recognize myself. I started covering up mirrors in the hospital room. I started, you know, wearing long sleeve shirts and pants so I wouldn't see what was happening with my body. Because I think I wanted to be blissfully unaware. And
say that one more time. You want to be fully?
Blissfully unaware.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow. Fully unaware.
Yeah.
Powerful. That is powerful. So what we're going to do, we're talking to Monica Curiel, talking about her experience as with Hodgkin's lymphoma, and we will take a quick break, and we'll come back, and feel free to stay with us. And we're answering our question of the day, are you refusing to concede? Our number here is 310-861-2331. And you're listening on cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. We'll be right back.
How do you lead a people who are starved, who are broken, who are isolated?
You lead them where they are, by getting them on cue with God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on the queue.
I learned more about the heart of leadership than the art of leadership. What Eric Powell does in this session is makes the leader in you come alive.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue.
It should be a mandatory part of every church pre-membership class, every school leadership program. I think this curriculum effectively used not only positions a person for better leadership, but positions a person for better life.
And we're back. Thanks for staying with us. You're listening to On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Remember, our mission here is simple, friends, to help you lead where you are by getting you on cue with God's will and His purpose. So today's question of the day, Monica's election, it is refusing to concede. Helping us with that is with you, so please call us at 310-861-2331. Helping us with that is our special guest, Monica Curiel, 20-year-old who has been waging her own campaign against Hodgkin's lymphoma, and she's young, gifted, and called in so many different ways. And right now, her calling is sharing her experience with others who is in the same position and helping us with that. Monica, thanks for staying with us through the break.
Oh, no, thank you so much.
Absolutely. So I just want to recap for those who just joined us. Coming from Dallas, going to L.A. to a very competitive, well-known fashion school, in the end of your freshman year, driving from the beach, singing, as you always do, blacked out. Blacked out.
Yeah, I did.
And you survived the wreck. Not only did you survive the wreck, but you were stuck in the car, but two good Samaritans came to save you. Two good angels came to save
you. Right.
While in the hospital, diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, and now, to the point where you're telling us your story, where you're in denial, you're scared, your parents, is everything's being put in perspective at that point. And were you questioning if you were strong enough for this disease?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, I was just like, when I'd pray, I would just, you know, say, God, what I understood really was that you give strong people these kind of things. And I was just like, you know, I'm not strong yet. I'm not able to face this yet. And so, I was just, you know, depressed, and I was sad, and I was finding it hard to really cope. Because naturally you think, okay, so now what's going to happen to my life? So I'm on a pause. And then you think, you don't want to think about your future, but then you're like, what is my future? You know, and through that experience, I was kind of able to, one of my friends referred me to this hospital called the City of Hope, that is a cancer known hospital, known for its research. And so I went, and I think it's been one of the greatest blessings of my life. I was blessed with a great team of doctors who were not only doing their job, but so compassionate and caring and so willing to kind of walk with me through the processes that, you know, one undergoes when, you know, one is diagnosed with any kind of illness. I think, you know, there's a certain level of shock and denial and confusion, and also, you know, a certain level of self-pity as well.
Sure.
And so, you know, it's kind of looking back on it, you know, every day I struggled. Every day was, how am I going to get through this? You know, trapped in four blank walls, essentially. I couldn't walk by myself. I couldn't eat. I was on a feeding tube. I had to learn how to breathe again after some of the surgeries. I had to learn how to use, you know, a little bit of my motor skills. And I think the scariest part really was when doctors would tell me what the risks are. I think my whole motto for the first year I had cancer was to be blissfully unaware. If I was unaware,
I was going to ask you what you meant by your pause, but I think you just described it, right?
Yeah, it was just, I mean, you know, the saying, ignorance is bliss.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't know, you don't have to deal with it, you know? And I think I didn't want to deal with it. I didn't want to deal with knowing if I had a 1% chance of living, knowing if I had 100% chance of living, because I didn't know if I would be able to kind of cope with going back into the real world. You see,
right.
Once you're put on a pause, you kind of don't know how to put on the switch again. So a lot of times I kind of felt like it was just better to be unaware, to not know. And the deepest struggles that I had to undergo was, you know, they were just like, be prepared in case, you know, you don't have children when you're older, or an increased chance of breast cancer because of the treatment we're giving you, or not being able to, you know, drive again, or, you know, use your motor skills. And for me as an artist, that was the scariest thing, was to think that I would have to, you know, I had the option of going the rest of my life without something I loved, which was to use my hands to draw, paint, to, you know, create. And yeah, it was scary. I thought, you know, I was going to lose it all.
So in a sense, you look at in your pause, you're what you're describing is being unable to cope, and you're at your toughest point, you're at your pit, you're at the lowest point of your life, and
right,
in a sense, it's time to concede, right?
Right.
And
right.
So how, tell me about that moment when it turned for you.
I think the turning point was when I couldn't sleep at night. And, you know, I thought, wow, is this all there is to the rest of my life, you know, in case the treatment doesn't work, because there's always a chance that the treatment's not going to work.
Right.
And I think the turning point was really asking for a chance to live better, was really asking for a chance to not live selfishly. I think a lot of times in our society, we're so persuaded that in order to find happiness, or find contentness, it's kind of a more thing. You know, my life will be more convenient if I get this that cuts my cost or my time in a certain way. And I realized at that moment that I was living a very fast-paced life. You know, I was going in a direction that I was proud of myself for, that society, you know, was like, yeah, fashion is great. And, you know, I was living a very selfish lifestyle. And I was, I found comfort. I was, you know, comfortable. And the turning point for me was really having all of that comfort gone and mm-hmm. not knowing. And having to be grateful for the days I could swallow water on my own, having to be grateful for the days that, you know, I could use the restroom on my own, pardon the, you know, example. But, you know, you don't realize how much you have really till it's gone, like the saying says. And the moments that I was able to eat, I thought, oh, my gosh, I can't even imagine just having breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And I want to have those. I want to live life. And I realized at that moment that I wasn't going to let that be the end of my life. Having that said, I did have moments where I was like, man, you know, God, if you're going to take me quick. I don't want pain, you know, like you don't want to have to go through all that stuff. And, you know, there was times where I was wanting to give up. I was wanting to say, you know, this is enough. I've had enough pain. You know, I lived enough. I loved, I traveled, I did this and that. Do I want to do more? Yes. But, you know, at a certain point, I was also struggling with the fact of too much acceptance, of being accepting that this was all I was going to get. And
right.
The only problem with that was that that deteriorates hope when one has too much acceptance. And then they don't have the will to kind of hope for the future. And so when I got, stuck with depression or different things that are, you know, caused by, deep kind of life traumas, I struggled in finding that hope. And
wow.
I think one of the ways I found it was through other people. And I didn't know I could do that. I didn't know that I could hope through other people's hope. I didn't think that was a thing. And that's why we have people around and friends and family. And I think allowing myself to be helped was really the key in that.
So you wrote a piece related to the City of Hope. And one part, we got a question coming up, but there's someone on the line got a question or comment for you. But I wanted to ask you this one phrase that just stuck me, and it's probably coincided with a lot of the time you're talking about. You said, I was worth fighting for. Talk about
that
phrase.
That was a very difficult phrase for me to come to a conclusion. I felt like a lot of the times I felt bad for the people who had to be my caregivers, for the friends that would come and visit me, for my parents who had to stop their work, and my brothers and sisters who were worried, you know, sick. And I was like, you know, really struggling with my self-worth. If I'm this sick, am I really worth trying to live more? And there came a point where I was inspired to want to be more, to be worth that. And I had to think about what gave me that self-worth, what would help me to help others. Why should I be here? Why should I live? And there was a moment that came that I said, you know what? I'm worth surviving. I'm worth, trying to continue a lifetime, trying to set new goals and redirect myself. And I think that's essential to when one is feeling down, is finding your self-worth and your motivation to, you know, keep one foot in front of the other, so to say.
Yep, finding your self-worth. So we're going to take a moment. We have a call. You have a comment?
A comment.
You know this voice, Monica?
Hi, Monica. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. This person said, being a survivor of ovarian cancer in a sickle cell patient, I want to encourage you to stay strong and take each day as a gift. Now that you have come with your terms with your conditions, what advice would you give to other young girls just diagnosed with lymphoma?
Wow, that leads right into kind of part of what we're going to talk about a little bit later. But Monica, go ahead and address that.
Yeah, I think to anyone who is recently diagnosed, not just with cancer, but, you know, with any kind of limited disease, to not let that disease define you. You have to be accepting of it being there, of the fact that you have to face it, But don't let that be the reason that your life is paused. You can still live and embrace life without having to do so in the manner that everyone else does it. Take that time to really reevaluate what matters most in your life and to prioritize what your goals are.
Great, great answer. Great answer and great question, which really leads into the entire piece where you put together some thoughts on helping others, you know, during your pause, coming out of your pause. I'm worth fighting, Lord, bringing you out of that, giving you purpose, right? Giving you self-worth,
right,
but also giving you purpose at the same time, allow you to give individuals these points. And that first one that you just shared with the person on the live chat room about do not allow cancer or any disease to define you, it is critical. So what's the second point you wanted to share with those who've experienced or are experiencing what you've gone through?
I think it would really be to not be afraid to ask and seek help. I think that when you're so limited in a circumstance such as what cancer does, you feel very dependent on others. And that dependent, for me, caused a lot of problems because, you know, I just had left, you know, the nest and I wanted to start this new life and aim for my career and live by myself and do all these things independently. That having to be dependent on people all over again was really difficult. And it was in seeking help, being okay with the fact that I didn't have that independence for right now, you know, and being okay with understanding that I wasn't being a burden to people. But you have to realize, too, that when you allow people to help you, they're also being helped themselves by that same service.
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it was also a time for me to, you know, acknowledge that in asking for help, I was helping people, and vice versa. So now I'm able to help others, and I want others to feel comfortable in seeking that help.
And, absolutely. Amazing how God turns that around with you when the things you're needing and you use that to help other people is also helping you at the same time. It's amazing.
Right.
It's amazing. We're going to take, Monica, we're going to take another quick break, and we're talking to Monica Curiel, who, as you know, is a more than just campaigning against her own cancer, but she's here, she's had a great story, she has a testimony, and she's talking about her pause and how the Lord brought her out her pause, and now she's refusing to concede on this great disease. So feel free to give us a call at 310-861-2231 to ask her a question or make a comment, or press one on your telephone if you want to do that, or log into our live chat room at Blog Talk on Q Radio, and we can have a conversation there. We would love to hear from you, friends. Our number is 310-861-2331. This is On Q. I'm your host, Eric Powell. We'll be right back.
They are by getting them on cue with God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on the queue.
I learned more about the heart of leadership than the art of leadership. What Eric Powell does in this session is makes the leader in you come alive.
Let us help you get on cue.
It should be a mandatory part of every church pre-membership class, every school leadership program. I think this curriculum effectively used not only positions a person for better leadership, but positions a person for better life.
And we're back. Thanks for staying with us. You're listening to On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Remember, our mission here is simple, friends, to help you lead where you are by getting you on cue with God's will and his purpose he has for you on your life. So today's question, we're talking to Monica Curiel, our special guest, who's 20-year-old fashion student who's waging her own campaign against Hodgkin's lymphoma. She's young, gifted, and she's called to share her story, her testimony, her advice to others who are in their position, and helping us really answer the question of the day, refusing to concede. So, Monica, thanks for staying with us.
Thank you so much. I'm having fun.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, we've gone through, you shared some things and things I didn't know of the point where at the depth of your pause. And I think it hit me right before the break. We were talking about you're sharing some key points, some key elements to those who've gone through your experience that you. And the first one was really don't allow the disease to or the cancer to find you, and the second one is to seek help and don't be afraid to ask for help. Before we jump into the next few though. I just want to make an observation, and if you agree or not agree, if you can expound on, you're at your pause, though. You're hearing what you just shared with us, you are not supposed to come out of that pause.
Right. I am still at my pause, and I've had cancer twice, and I was supposed to still be on my first pause. Mm-hmm. Pause meaning, not being able to go to school or to work. After being diagnosed last year, I had to kind of move back home and get back on kind of remission schedule, which is just meaning more of a stress-free environment, not returning to work or school due to, health reasons. And so in the midst of being cancer-free last year, I had to, registered to attend seven schools, obviously trying to pick one, and got into six of them, decided to go to the University of Kansas because I decided to change my career path. After having cancer the first time, I really felt like God was calling me to do something more for the community. And I've changed that to a career in art therapy and working with children who particularly have these illnesses or impediments that, they can't verbally speak or can't see, and using art and music really as a means to cope if they can't do so just verbally. And so I want to be in a more laid-back environment And I found that in Kansas. And I had some, you know, friends from the fashion industry, you know, just kind of comment on, you know, why I would go in the middle of nowhere.
Right.
And then I got the cancer again during my first semester there. And I am once again in a pause, having recovered for a second time from the same cancer. And it's, it's kind of difficult to not do anything. So to say in a way where kind of dreams are almost broken. I had this dream of graduating from college in 2 years and being the first one in my family to graduate, kind of having that set goal and having an obvious valid reason to have a pause on that, but not being able to complete that is very difficult. And I have found, too, that, you know, God allows these pauses in our life to, like I said before, reset goals and kind of rethink and reimagine, you know, what your purpose is. And so, you know, I found a different purpose, one that I never thought I would, you know, be accomplishing. But, you know, a pause is good. A pause is not always bad.
Absolutely. And thanks for sharing that. Dreams are almost broken. But, you know, we hear your spirit. We feel your spirit. If anyone probably never met you, but they can feel you, that you're strong. You'll get through this pause as well. Getting back to the experience or the advice that you would share with those your own pause, who's going through it, or have a family member that's going through that pause. We gave us two points. What's another one? What's the third point you would share with someone about getting through your pause?
I think it's really good to, for me personally, it has been really developing a relationship with my medical team. Because for me and many of the people that I know who have had cancer, there's almost this lingering fear of it coming back, of any time you get sick or weak, that has something to do with cancer. And so I think it's a really good idea for people to develop a good relationship with their doctors. Because a lot of times what we're fearful for, we don't fully comprehend. And we worry that there's something more. But talking to your doctor and the nurses and medical team and researching really helps you understand what you need.
Yep. So in a sense, it's the if I go back to your point earlier, blissful unaware. It's not being blissfully unaware in this case, right?
Right, yeah. I think the more, in this case, it's you need reassurance that you're going to be okay, because a lot of times our emotional needs cloud our judgment. And sometimes you just need someone who has the scientific facts to make you feel, you know, secure, to make you feel like everything's going to be okay, whether that be through a therapist or a doctor or counselor. You know, it's a healthy part of the coping process, the moving on, the pause.
Amen to that. And so when you go through that, you know, all of these things, what you share tonight is your testimony, Lord's molding through you. How important is it to talk or write about it as probably one of the other key elements that you share with individuals?
Oh, I think it's very important. I think to talk or to write about any struggle you're undergoing is essential to really not letting it bottle up inside of you. you know, as a kid, I always wrote in my diary, and I have several friends who still write in their diaries, and I think it's a very good way to, you know, express what you're feeling. A lot of people are very into blogging now, into posting, into sharing, because there's almost an essence of you're not alone, that you can express what you're going through, and you can find people who are undergoing the same thing and find it to be very helpful.
Yeah, it's amazing. It's amazing what that does for you, just writing and just talking about it. Absolutely vital. You know, you talked about, you've given us a few points on, you know, would you share your story, how to help individuals who are going through. The number one was don't allow cancer to define you. The second was seeking help, but do not be afraid to help, ask for help. The third, as recapping for the audience, to develop a good relationship with your medical team. The fourth is talk or write about your struggle. And then this next one is key. You could actually start with this and talk about the next one.
Yeah, I think this one is really the most important. And I didn't bring it up first because all of the things that lead to it are surrounded by it. And I think keeping the faith, the hope, in the struggle is essential. A lot of times I felt depressed. I felt alone. I felt hopeless. I felt needy. I didn't think that other people would really understand me. And like I said before, I was clinging on to their hope, living vicariously through their lives because I felt like mine wasn't, you know, going anywhere, or I wasn't doing anything. And I found what was most helpful was finding my faith, was finding that hope. And having that said, you don't have to be a religious person to necessarily agree or understand the statement. It could be practicing things that make you happy and productive. So for me, that was you know, drawing when I could, or listening to music, or watching movies that were more therapeutic. You know, I didn't know how to pray during my time isolated in the hospital. I didn't know how to reach out. But I found that in listening to music, in listening to, let's say, one of my favorites during treatment was listening to Hillsong United, listening to things that were uplifting, like, you know, my country music, or listening to things that, you know, reminded me that I was, you know, young and that, you know, I still had a lot of life to live. So that was a little bit of Kanye. That was a little bit of, you know, Iggy Azalea. That was, you know, just finding these different kind of things to keep the faith. And, you know, I really was trying to understand what God's will for me was the purpose of my life. You know, there's never going to be a call that comes down, but that, you know, that was something that I thought, what can I utilize? What do I have? What, you know, what do I possess that could really be helpful to the people around me, to this community that I'm now a part of? So keeping the faith was, you know, the hope, the love, you know, keep going, was really essential for me.
Wow. And so keeping the faith, and it's God's will, it's basically using what you have. You ask the question of, you know, what can you utilize, what you possess? It's your story. It's the things that your pause in a lot of different ways, and your talents and your interests and passions all wrapped up. And it is amazing to hear that. So as you coming out of the pause, going in another pause,
right.
You know, this one of these last points is also critical to helping cope. You've used that a lot. Exactly right. It's a coping mechanism. And
right.
So
tell us about this last point about what we all, even I can think about some things right now in my life that I could use this on, but tell us about it.
I think this, you know, this next point really wraps it up, and the fact that at any point in our lives, it's important to be in the present, and to be most in the present is to practice letting go and making use of the life that you have now. I think that's applicable to anyone in any circumstance, that a lot of times when we've had it good, whether that be in a romantic relationship, whether that be academically, whether that be in our, you know, careers or in our families, that, you know, at one point there's always like a highlight. You know, it's the wedding day, or it's the day your kid was born, but then your kid's like in their preteens and they're not listening, and there's hormones, or, you know, it's that, you know, time in high school when you were prom queen, you know, or something. And it's really practicing letting go and saying, this is what I'm working with now, is saying, you know, I can't mourn the past or how good I used to look, which was a thing that I, you know, kept saying to myself is, oh, I used to complain about my looks all the time, and, you know, that I wanted to work out more. I wanted to be like the girls on Pinterest and Tumblr and Instagram, and I wanted to, you know, be this ideal image, and how grateful I became for just how I looked prior to. And I think you should really not live the rest of your life in fear, and fear that you're never going to have that highlight of your life, or you're never going to, you know, be the same without, you know, this thing in your life. For me, it's practicing the fear that whether the cancer comes again, that I will be okay, that I'm going to live for today, and I'm not going to worry about tomorrow, and I'm just going to do what I can, because really in life, we don't know what's going to happen. We don't know if we're going to get fired from our jobs. We don't know if our kid's going to get sick. We don't know if our spouse is going to be there. We're only going through these motions that become a lifestyle because, you know, nothing's shaken them. But there's nothing in life that makes, you know, that makes you safe from all of these things. So in practicing to let go, one practices to live life fully and presently. And I think that's really important for anyone, is to learn to do that.
Well, tomorrow's not a promise, right?
Yeah, tomorrow's not a promise. So you know, we really have to live like we're dying, like Tim McGraw's song says, you know, is really the best way I can put that in a nutshell, is, you know, to go out and do things for people, and to not live selfishly, but to live a life where you can share that love, that care for one another. And, you know, to remember to say I love you to the people who you love, even if you're in an argument, even if you haven't talked to that person in 15 years.
Sure.
To really show that you care, because tomorrow isn't promised. And I'll tell you, none of my best friends foresaw my cancer coming. I didn't. But, you know, boy, I never thought that I had, you know, top-of-the-line friends till, you know, pushed comes to shove, and they were there.
Wow.
You know, yeah,
wow.
It's important.
You're so right. It's as Paul tells you, got to die daily, and it is. You're so right. You know, war time flies.
Right.
This story of yours is so rich, and hopefully we've done it justice tonight, because I'm sure there's a lot more, but this is what we're all about, highlighting people like you who has a testimony, who wants to share, who's come out of their pause, right? And it's just so amazing to hear it and be able to react to it. And that's why I didn't ask you more about it when we talked earlier, because I wanted to just have that raw reaction to some of the things that you didn't share with me earlier. But amazing. But, you know, before we go, though, Monica, how do we, those who are listening and friends and family, support you in your current efforts and what you're doing?
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share with you what kind of my project is right now. Is I'm developing a children's book, and I'm hopefully wanting to make a series in which is really a therapeutic manner, using vibrant colors, you know, very simple, you know, drawing styles to ease the process that one undergoes during cancer treatment. And in order to help me in that cause is I'm taking some donations to publish my book at GoFundMe.com under my name, Monica Curiel, as well as another page I have for the City of Hope in order to raise money through my book for cancer research at thecityofhope.org.
Okay, so we got GoFundMe.com. And Monica Curiel, that's C-U-R-I-E-L, right? And then then you have...
Our hope dot cityofhope.org.
Okay, ourhope.cityofhope.org. Okay.
Yes.
I'll make sure I post that out there as well. And even as you can post it on the invitation, if you like, on my page, either way it goes. So with that, that's how people find you, through the GoFundMe or Our Hope or CFO. Any other means of contacting you, sharing the story? Because I'm sure there may be a couple publishers I know or maybe listening that may be interested in hearing.
You can contact me at MONI, J as in Jayhawk, 1993@gmail.com. That's my personal email. So,
thanks for sharing this. So, last question, Monica. What can we be in prayer with you about?
I think the best thing to pray about is that, you know, for people who are really undergoing the struggle to want to keep going, to pray for those. To find hope, to pray to be a sense of light to those who are struggling, and to pray for one another and ourselves to become a little bit more selfless each day. And that's how, you know, we can make the world a better place, I think.
Well, you know, that shows so much more about you because you didn't ask anything specifically for you.
Oh, no. I have all that I need. I'm living. I am happy, and I'm going to continue living, let's hope. So, you know, we just have to pray for one another and be one another's, you know, friends and carry out, you know, the message that, you know, we really should treat others like we would like to be treated. And I think that's especially important to remember in traffic jams.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. Those who are listening, if you don't realize that that this is genuine and real and of God, you know, it is. And so find your way to GoFundMe, find your way to City of Hope, and support Monica and her efforts as she continues to give of herself selflessly and be a hope for someone else and be a light for someone else. Monica, thank you. Thank you for blessing us tonight with your testimony, your story. Absolutely moving.
Thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share it. I'll tell you, if one person is helped by it, then I did my job. I can leave in peace, you know. I thank you. And you do great work. Great work.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Everybody, that was Monica Curiel. Great testimony, great story about her pause in her life, dealing with Hodgkin lymphoma, and twice,
at a very, very young age, even before she turns 21, and dreams somewhat deferred, but she is an inspiration to many, and she's absolutely, Lord's called her to do some great things. He's not done with her yet. When all is lost, and sure, she's been one of those who've dealt with it, when it's time to give up, everyone, everything around you is telling you to admit defeat, to really concede to your struggles, as Monica shared with us tonight, and either concede to your problems or concede to the way you toil, concede to your overdue bills or concede to, your challenge of your children in trouble. We started the show talking about concession speeches, and we talked about people not really admitting defeat and then praising the opponent. It's a thank you to those. It's a unity, and we need to come together. It's a common purpose. It's a fight. We must continue because this is real, and we thank the Lord for that. To Monica's point, and she shared her few points about how to endure. If you were to turn that piece, those parts of those concession speeches we hear from politicians in the opposite order, it starts with God in prayer. Then it goes to our fight to continue, Lord, because I'm anchoring in you. And at that point, it's a higher purpose. What is your will, Lord? And what's your purpose you have for me? And, Lord, in that unity, we can come together on one accord and continue to give you thanks. And I'm going to praise you, not just the challenger, not just to who I'm campaigning against, but the hardships, the toil, the hopelessness. No matter what it is, I'm going to praise you. I'm not going to give up because I'm going to endure because as long as I anchor myself in the counselor, the ultimate healer, Christ himself. Like Monica, our guest, did. She did not allow cancer to define herself, so don't you. Whatever your cancer is, if it's jobs, if it's likes, if it's your world, if it's your troubles, seek your identity from the master. And because the creation, remember this, the creation cannot determine what it's created for. So God gets your identity from the master himself. So just like Monica, seek help. Things may not seem bleak right now. There may be a challenge. May have lost hope or lost faith, but don't be afraid to ask for help, but you seek help from the master. You know, just like Monica, who developed a relationship with your doctor, she tells her that she talks to her doctor frequently, but I'm talking about not of the physical one, but the spiritual doctor. So make the master your doctor in all your problems and all your struggles, to help you understand what you need. And just like Monica, talk and write about your struggles. Be your testimony. Allow your misery to be your ministry. Share your testimony with others. Not only tell the master about your struggles, but let your ministry continue to shine a light and selflessly and hope in others. And as our guest Monica talked about, keep your faith in all your listlessness. If it's hopelessness, it's faithlessness. Wherever you are, if in depression, cling to that master and have faith and seek the master's will. But you must practice your faith in order doing that. So just like Monica, practice letting go. Make sure the use of your life have right now. Don't be consumed by film or fear or circumstances. And as the people say, and let go and let God. But I'm asking you to let go and give it to the master. So when you can't see through, when you're in your pause, if you find yourself in jail, find yourself in before the court, find yourself in a pit, find yourself in a fire, or find yourself even in the lion's den, or even find yourself on the cross somewhere. Don't refuse not to concede. You go to the master. As my childhood pastor would say, he'll fix it if you trust him. But if he can fix your race, he can fix your election, he can fix your calling, he can fix your pause. Only thing you got to do is profess it. Jesus is Lord. Keep your faith. Praise. And keep your thanks, all those things raised, and he'll get you out of your pause. So with that, we thank you for joining us tonight. Kennedy will close us out. God bless.
Before we go, we thank our special guest, Monica Curiel. We thank you for tuning in. We hope that our ministry helps you get on cue with the Lord. I have an ask for all of you. Put us on your prayer list. Like us on Facebook at OnQ Radio. Follow us on Twitter at Q Leadership. And invite a friend to listen to this show and to next week's show. If you are a leader in the church, on the field, at home, at work, in the community, or anywhere, consider us to enhance your leadership. For more information, go to our website, www.qleadership.org or .com. If you would like to be a sponsor, please email us at onq@qleadership.com. Also, be on the lookout for my dad's book, Leader in the Mirror, which will be out next month. We give all honor and praise to Christ our Savior. I'm sure my dad thanks his producer, assistant me, his better half, best friend, and wife, my mom, my little sister Carson, all of our family, friends in life, and on Facebook. We dedicate this show to all those who are struggling with their own election and all the veterans who have served our country proud. Last but not least, we dedicate the show to my grandparents who would have celebrated their 56th anniversary this weekend. This has been OnQ Radio. Until next week, get on cue with God's will, get on cue with God's election on your life, and get others on cue with that election.
How do you lead a people who are starved, who are broken, who are isolated?
You lead them where they are by getting them on cue for God's will, by getting them on cue for His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on cue.
Let us help you get on cue.